This is Main Street on Prairie Public, the time and place that we come together to hear ideas and voices. I'm Ashley Thornburg, and today on the show, the Fargo Film Festival is coming up. The theater's executive director shares details. We continue our series on women making history, this time the woman who launched Australia's wool industry. Chef Rosie chews the fat about sunflower seeds. But first, meteorites and what we can learn about space from what has landed on Earth. Nels Forsman has a PhD in geology and is an assistant professor at the University of North Dakota, and he joins me by phone. He ID'd the state's largest known meteorite back in 1999 and now holds a slice of the Colgate meteorite to study. Nels, thank you so much for joining me today.
Nice to be here.
Why study meteorites?
Well, meteorites are only samples of the original material from which every object in the solar system formed. Earth, comets, asteroids, meteorites are pieces from busted up asteroids. And so it's the representative of the earliest material that hasn't been changed tremendously, so we can't understand the beginnings. With meteorite study, we can have a good idea of the beginnings of the solar system formation.
We're talking billions of years old, these meteorites, by the time.
We're talking 4.6 billion years. In fact, meteorites are what give us the age of Earth. Before we had radiometric dating, we had to make guesses about the age of Earth, but a very good geologist, a brilliant man that most people haven't heard of, his name is James Hutton, he figured out that time is actually immense. We refer to that today as deep time. He didn't know how old Earth was. He said it's just unimaginably old. And today we have radiometric dating, and we can't date Earth rocks to figure out how old the planet is because the planet has been so modified by plate tectonics and metamorphism and reheating. And so we get the building blocks of the planets, like I said, meteorites, to figure out the age of the entire solar system. And it turns out the first meteorite we dated to get the age for the solar system was a meteorite that landed in North Dakota, the Richardson meteorite, back in about 1908.
Mm-hmm. And so named, meteorites get their names basically by the town closest to where they're found. Is that always true, or is that somehow a North Dakota thing?
That's always true unless there isn't a town nearby. For instance, if you go to what's called Meteor Crater, Arizona, which scientists refer to as the Barringer Crater, there's no nearby town for the meteorites that were associated with making that crater. The pieces survived, and so what to name them? We named them after the nearest permanent geographic named feature, and that's a canyon, Canyon Diablo. So it's a river canyon. So mostly we name meteorites after towns, but sometimes after other landmark named features.
How is it that meteorites are landing on Earth? Because isn't there quite a process of breaking up as they're, you know, shooting through the atmosphere?
Boy, there sure is. And something starting out about the size of a minivan will tremendously break up in the atmosphere, and what remains to hit the ground might be only the size of a football.
Okay. So lots of pressure.
Yes. In fact, the pressure is so high with the atmosphere pushing back against that incoming object that most people think that the objects are melting on their way in. They're actually not. They're sublimating. They're turning to vapor. And so it's amazing that any survives to hit the ground. The biggest ones, of course, just punch through the atmosphere and explode when they hit the ground to produce a crater. But the smaller, well, you have to be, you know, at least 50 meters in diameter to have any chance of that happening.
Yeah, but there have been reports over the course of history of meteorites that as they have landed, I mean, they could be seen over 400 square miles. They could be heard some 250 square miles in distance.
Oh, sure. Yeah, the one just, the fireball in Chelyabinsk, Siberia, just back in 2013. It's on the media. I think everybody's probably seen footage of that. Yeah, that was a fireball that was, I think it burst apart initially about 28 miles above the surface, but pieces continued down to produce the fireball streaks in the sky. And it took a little while before that air burst then made it to the ground, the compressed air burst that you saw breaking out windows and scaring people.
For the few that do make it to Earth's surface, what are they most likely to look like? Do they kind of look like sort of abnormal rocks?
Actually, I have people call me commonly saying that they think they have a meteorite, and I'll ask them to describe it, and they'll say it's a funny-looking rock. And I'll have to tell them right off, well, then it's probably not a meteorite. Because meteorites actually are boring-looking. They're very plain-looking. They don't have multiple colors making them up. They look like a chocolate brown rock sitting on the ground, so you wouldn't really notice them as anything unusual that you should pick up. Iron meteorites, on the other hand, you wonder, what's that chunk of iron doing out in my field or in the middle of that desert? And those we pick up in a biased way. We're more likely to notice those, and they actually survive weathering longer than the stony meteorites sitting on the ground. So to figure out what's coming from space, we don't look at the found meteorites. We look at the what are called falls, meteorites that were seen to fall, and then we go and pick them up. Then our recognition bias doesn't come into play, and the preservation bias doesn't come into play. We saw it fall, we go pick it up, and it turns out that 94% then of what's falling in from space is what I just talked about, the boring, stony-looking meteorite.
Okay, but let's assume you didn't see it fall, but somebody did call, say, I have this object, kind of describes it, perks up your ears that it might in fact be a meteorite. What is the process for identifying that?
What I do is ask them a few more questions over the phone to see if it is worth their time to bring it in to me or not. And if it seems that it is worth their time, I encourage them to come, but don't come right away. Come when you're making another trip to Grand Forks.
Okay.
And they do, and then we go through and look at it, and then I assess it in front of them. And if it's not a meteorite, I don't beat around the bush. I let them know it's not. And then what I'll do is spend time with them showing them actual meteorites and giving them sort of a meteorite short course so that their time traveling to Grand Forks is felt to be worthwhile by them.
Once an educator.
Yeah. Well, I feel for people that drove quite a distance thinking they had a meteorite. I don't want to just have them arrive here and say, nope, not a meteorite. I've looked at hundreds and hundreds of stones from the public over my years here, and only four meteorites have turned up from that. So I had a fellow here yesterday who thought he had a meteorite from Mars.
Hmm.
And he is very intelligent and gave all the reasons that he thought it was a meteorite from Mars, but by when he left, he realized it's not. And yet he felt very, very that it was a worthwhile trip for him, and that's what I try to do.
It sounds like an episode of Antiques Roadshow in the making all the time. Is this worth something?
Oh, sometimes they ask what they're worth, and I'll say, well, really, they're priceless to science. Every meteorite offers the chance of showing us something new about the origin of the solar system. But if you're asking me what a collector would pay for these, it's the collectors that determine the price of meteorites. And I'll show them a meteorite that I purchased 20 years ago for $100 a pound, and that meteorite today would be $1,000 per pound.
Okay.
So the price is all determined by the collectors.
What can happen, though, from a researcher's perspective, if too much ends up in the hands of private collectors or just they get too expensive? Does that impact research?
If scientists have not yet seen a meteorite that a collector has, then that's too bad. You know, then we miss out on getting the scientific information from. But most of the time, I think people bring specimens to universities or museums or call the Smithsonian even, or send it to the Smithsonian. I've seen people do that. And so scientists do get a chance to look at them. A problem is many geologists do not have a knack at recognizing a meteorite when they see one. So I teach a class here in space geology, and I teach my students how to get that knack so they themselves can go out and find meteorites. What the first thing you want to do is realize what a meteorong looks like. and then you can eliminate. If none of the meteorong characteristics are present, then you can think, okay, it might be a meteorite. Like I say, meteorites are pretty boring looking. But I think most of the time people bring suspected meteorites to a university or a museum. So I don't think collectors have a lot of meteorites that we've not yet looked at.
Okay. Let's talk about this Colgate meteorite. It comes in around 84 pounds, which, of course, if it's starting out in space, around the size of a minivan seems small. But for meteorites, by the time they get to Earth, is quite a large meteorite.
Yeah, that's a pretty big one. You should think maybe there's other pieces of it scattered or elsewhere around the region. 84 pounds, 86 pounds, it's... It's a big one, yep.
Yeah, take me back to, it was 1999 when you were the first person to say, to confirm that this is a meteorite. Take me back to that moment. What do you remember about first seeing the Colgate meteorite?
Well, Todd Erickson, who lives near Colgate, North Dakota, thought that he had a meteorite, and he contacted me, and he brought it to campus, and I said right away, yep, you got one. He had excavated a basement for a new home and decided not to build a home yet, and he didn't want the walls to collapse in, and so he had neighbors and people bring rocks from rock piles to fill in that excavation. And then later he decided, okay, I'm going to go ahead and remove those rocks to build the house. And in pulling the rocks out, then he noticed this one. Oh, wow, I wonder if that's a meteorite. Yeah, he brought it, and we identified it in 99 as a meteorite. Yep, and it's one of the standard types. It's a stone.
And now more recently, you have been able to get a slice of that meteorite to study. That just happened a couple days ago, right?
Yes. See, we can't classify and name a meteorite. Well, we can classify a meteorite, but we can't give it a name and get it formally documented in the literature unless a piece. This is a new rule. The American Meteorological Society has a new rule where you have to keep a piece at the naming facility, at the curatorial facility. And so Todd Erickson passed away. His son is now handling the meteorite, and he happens to be a student at UND. So this was great, and he agreed to have a slice taken off. We took a very small slice, not any more than we needed, for curatorial purposes here, in case other scientists want to do more study, then they need to know where they can get the specimen. And, of course, the owner doesn't want scientists continually contacting them. So, yeah, and I have a graduate student who is, an undergraduate student who's looking for a career in planetary science, and he decided to do a study of this Colgate to classify it, and that's a good start for him in getting a career later on when he goes to graduate school in planetary science.
How do you slice a meteorite? You can't just use a regular saw.
Especially one this big, you need a big diameter blade on the saw. Just a big circular saw with a large blade, and it has diamonds embedded in the cutting surface. Mm-hmm. Now, you don't have to have diamonds because a meteorite, the hardness of the specimen, it's only on a scale of 0 to 10, meteorites have a hardness, stony meteorites have a hardness of about 5.5. And, of course, diamonds have a hardness of 10, so you can have other blades that can still... It's like you're cutting a rock.
Okay.
And but we needed a large blade. The blade we had a blade years ago. I've cut many meteorites, but we were without a blade for years. We just purchased a new one. They're about $500 to $600 for a blade like that. But, it cuts so nice now, and so we got a really nice slice off this thing.
Well, now, what will you do with that? Of course, you said it's largely a procedural sort of curatorial part that you have the slice. But for researching that, what are you really looking at when you're looking at a slice of meteorite, and how does that really lend itself to knowing the origins of the solar system?
Yeah,
that's a huge question.
No, that's fine. The first thing we do with the meteorite sample is have a thin section made. A thin section is made from you send a very small billet about the size of you've seen microscope slides?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, a glass microscope slide. It's about the size of that, and we'll send it out away for a thin section company to slice a chunk of the meteorite down to thinness, thinner than a sheet of paper, and it's then glued on a microscope slide so you can shine light through the bottom of it, up through the eyepieces, and you use what's called a petrographic microscope to study thin sections of rocks, and in the thin section you see all the minerals that comprise the meteorite, and meteorites have inclusions in them. They're mineralogic, they're minerals, but they're spherical, and these spherical things are called chondrules, and chondrules represent the earliest material that condensed and came together from the original nebular spinning disk cloud that formed all the planets. And so we're looking at the original condensed materials in those chondrules. And with modern technology, which we're not doing that here at UND, we're just looking at the elemental ratios, the iron oxide and iron sulfide information, and the metal information. All these meteorites also contain iron, nickel iron metal flecks throughout. We use those things to give the classification. an H4 or H5 is what this will turn out to be. But if somebody else wanted to look at it and study the chondrules, those are the original, more or less pristine materials from the solar system that give us the information about element partitioning in the solar system or static discharges going off, temperatures, energies involved. You can really get a lot of information with meteorites if you really get in and study them.
We have just a few seconds left, but I have to ask you, what is it to feel like to hold one? Do you ever get overwhelmed thinking this is 4.6 billion years old?
Well, I tell you what, I make sure my students get to hold a meteorite in their hand and what they learn. See, meteorites come from the busted up asteroids, and certain meteorites come from the core of an asteroid. Other meteorites come from the mantle of an asteroid. Other meteorites come from lava flows that sat on top of the asteroid. So when I have them hold a meteorite in their hands, I have them think about what they're holding, and they realize they're holding the core of an asteroid in their hand. It's fun.
Dr. Nels Foreman is an assistant professor at the University of North Dakota at the Harold Hamm School of Geology. Thank you so much for joining us today.
You're very welcome. It was fun.
Coming up next, we're going to preview the Fargo Film Festival.
Support is provided by Drs. Kirk Coyer and Phil Sondrel of Urgent Med, providing personalized walk-in medical care for all ages 7 days a week in South Fargo. Urgent Med, where urgent care doesn't feel like urgent care.
This week on Away with Words, we address a question from a certain NPR quiz show.
I was listening to Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me a couple of weeks ago, like I usually do, and they were talking about a word in German, and they swore it was true. The word is Zipfelsuppe.
Peter Sagal, we have your back.
Join us.
Wow, that's great.
Away with Words. This week's Prairie Public Presents, coming up Sunday afternoon at 5 Central, 4 Mountain.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. It's March, and for major film buffs, that means one thing. North Dakota's biggest film festival, the Fargo Film Festival, is right around the corner. Emily Beck is the executive director for the Fargo Theater, and she joins John Harris for this week's Prairie Pulse television show. Here's an excerpt.
Emily, thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure, John. Thanks for having me.
Films come from all over the world. Mm-hmm. Talk a little bit about that. I mean, 300 films were submitted, mm-hmm. and so are really most of them from the United States, though, and you know, how many international films do you get?
I would say at least a third of our submissions are international. So while the bulk does come from the United States still, the Fargo Film Festival is starting to make a name for ourselves on the international festival circuit, so we're starting to see that number increase.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, can you talk about the volunteers and the number of hours that it takes for them to watch all these movies and
absolutely
judge them, I guess, so to speak? Yeah,
yeah, absolutely. We are a volunteer-driven film festival. We have a team of 60-odd people in this community and then some from out of town as well, volunteer their time as jurors. They are able to watch the films through a secure online account. And they can watch them in the comfort of their homes, and then they all get together based on their category, and they make those discussions, and they deliberate, and they decide which films will be selected. Our volunteers work so very hard. I know the narrative feature jury had 5,000 minutes worth of content to screen because we had a record number of submissions in that category, so they had 5,000 minutes to comb through.
Wow. Mm-hmm. Do you limit submissions in any category? I mean, it's wide open?
Well, so far we've been so excited about our growth that we haven't done that yet. Okay. That might be down the road somewhere. For now, we're open to all.
Okay. The quality of the films has increased over the years. Can you talk some about that?
Well, I think so. I mean, I might be a little bit biased, but our juries are doing great work to bring in top-level content, whether they be Academy Award nominees or films that have achieved great success at other major film festivals like, you know, Sundance or Tribeca, things like that. Our jury chairs do often solicit those films to enter into competition, but then we've been quite fortunate as the festival has continued to make a name for itself that sometimes these higher-profile films just come to us on their own, too.
What about your attendance? What kind of attendance do you have for people coming to the festival?
Well, the year before last, we broke our all-time attendance record with over 7,000. Last year, we were literally six people short of that. So I am bound and determined to break that record again this year, and I think we can do that, yeah.
Okay. Talk about, because it's not just sitting in the theater watching the films and seeing the guests there. There are pre-parties and lunches that go on. Can you tell us more about that?
Yeah, I mean, I think the social activities are a huge part of the festival. You get a chance to really have a conversation with somebody that could be visiting from Australia or, you know, New York or L.A., of course. We do parties at different downtown restaurants and bars before the evening showcase screenings. And we do lunch and panel discussions where you can have a great meal. And you can also hear some people in the industry discuss different topics related to filmmaking or, of course, topics in the films as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, the pre-parties, I assume, are just drinks and appetizers and things. Mm-hmm. Do you have guests there, too, that speak at the pre-parties, or is that more at the luncheons?
It is more at the luncheons that we have formal speakers. Mm-hmm. The parties are definitely kind of that more casual mix and mingle, get to know different people type atmosphere. It's great.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Talk about the festival a little bit of how it got started. I believe around 2000s when we...
Yeah, that's correct. That is a little bit before my time with the theater. In 2000, they started having meetings. Ted Larson and Margie Bailey, who I mentioned before, they were really the driving forces behind the creation of the film festival. A film festival is kind of a major cultural event in most American cities, and we didn't have one here in Fargo, and they thought it was time. First festival was held in 2001, grown significantly. The first festival had 30 films screened, and now we're up to over 100. And it's also become the Fargo Theater's major annual fundraiser event, too. So it's become a really important element in Fargo Theater operations as well.
Mm. Mm-hmm. So if somebody wanted to submit a film, what's the process to go through?
Well, our submissions will open probably late April, early May of this year, and they'll be able to submit their films through Film Freeway. It's an online submission platform. You just fill out a quick form and send a link of your film.
Well, you do that now. Has it always been that way?
It has definitely evolved. When I first started working at the theater, we were literally, you know, getting hundreds of, VHS tapes and DVDs in the mail, and every volunteer had to come and check them out and take them home and bring them back. And so we're very glad everything has shifted to an online platform that has just opened up a tremendous amount of possibility for us.
Sure. How is the Fargo Film Festival funded?
Oh, we have incredible sponsors. Bell Banks has been with us since the very beginning, along with Form and a few other really incredible businesses in this community. They sponsor the festival, and they make sure that they were able to bring in these great films, which do come with a price tag sometimes, and that we're able to have these wonderful guests come to us. And they ensure that it also continues to be a fundraiser for the Fargo Theater, which is, like I mentioned, now a very important part of the puzzle.
You've grown it significantly. Is there more growth? So what are the goals for the next few years?
Absolutely. We want to keep this growing. We want to build on the momentum that we've already achieved. Right now, we're a five-day festival. Our screenings are located pretty much solely at the Fargo Theater between our two auditoriums. In the next 10 years, I would love to just see us expand out into the entire community with parties and events and maybe find, you know, additional screening spaces, things like that, new partners. Maybe someday a lot of festivals are two-week festivals. Maybe that's in the cards for us someday. I'm excited to see where this can go.
Yeah, what would it take for that? Is it more submissions, more funding, all the above?
A little bit of everything. Yeah, we'd probably have to grow our volunteer base, grow our submissions, and then, like I said, find some new sponsors and partners for those venues.
What's the best part of your job, you think?
I love my job. I'm so lucky. I get to go to work every day and be surrounded by volunteers and staff members that are there because they love what they do. They're not there to make the big bucks. You know, I mean, they're either volunteering or they're a college kid working part-time or something like that. I feel very fortunate that I get to be surrounded by that network of people and that I get to be a part of something that's important to the community. The Fargo Theater is important to the community, to our history and to our present and our future, and that's a blessing.
Real quick, if people want more information, where can they go?
FargoFilmFestival.com.
All right. Thank you.
My pleasure.
Prairie Pulse airs at 7:30 Central, 6:30 Mountain on Friday on Prairie Public's television service. You can see the full interview and clips from several of the films on this week's episode. Still to come on Main Street, we hear another version of an uppity woman making history. Chef Rosie joins us to talk about sunflower seeds, and we have our What's Happening calendar of events. But now it's time for the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. North Dakota's 2018 U.S. Senate race may be starting to take shape. Bismarck Republican State Representative Rick Becker says he is seriously considering entering the race. If Becker wins the primary, he would face Democratic Senator Heidi Heitkamp.
I think she's very vulnerable, extremely vulnerable. You know, when she ran against Rick Berg, she didn't have a record. You know, that's a pretty nice situation to be in. And so now she's got a record, and many of her votes don't jive with what the majority of North Dakotans would view as their position. So now we actually can compare apples to apples.
Congressman Kevin Cramer has also been mentioned as a possible Senate candidate. Becker says he'll make a final decision on the race by late summer. People from cities who may lose their Department of Transportation shops packed a House of Appropriations subcommittee hearing in Bismarck. 8 shops would be closed under the DOT budget as passed by the state Senate. It would save about $2.1 million. But those who oppose the cuts said they're concerned about snow plowing and worry that relying on other DOT facilities could become a problem. Lyle Kovar is a city council member from New England.
Our school buses come across the road, west Highway 21, Highway 67 going south, which are secondary roads compared to, you know, interstates and whatever. So they'd probably be on the back end of the burner as far as getting plowed out.
The subcommittee will make a recommendation to the full House Appropriations Committee. That panel has to act before the House gets to vote on the bill. And officials with Fargo-Cass Public Health say while the incident of opioid overdose continues to grow nationwide, they are hoping greater awareness and assistance for those with an opioid problem will help prevent additional deaths. Part of that assistance will come in the form of administering naloxone, which is a medication that reverses the effects of an opioid overdose. Substance Abuse Prevention Coordinator Robin Litke-Saul says about 50 people were on hand for a train-the-trainer workshop Thursday. She says the morning-long course gives initial training on opioids and how to recognize and respond to an overdose situation.
So our hope is that most of these individuals that were here today will be able to go out and train other people and thus build the capacity for people able to, you know, rescue those from overdose.
Litke-Saul says in the U.S. there is a person overdosing on heroin, fentanyl, or other opioids once every 15 minutes. She says in 2016, the FM ambulance service responded to 99 overdose calls. She says by getting trained individuals into the community, they will be able to train others. Litke-Saul says having the awareness spread through the community will be an important tool in combating the problem. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
Most judges in North Dakota admit to having sent people to prison for drug and alcohol treatment. That's a problem, says the state's director of corrections.
I really think that jails and prisons have become a default answer to a problem that's very complex but has better solutions than incarceration.
Journeys Through Justice looks at how the criminal justice system works and how it might work better. That's Journeys Through Justice here on Prairie Public.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. Ever been in a situation where you did a lot of work and didn't get much credit for it? Well, that has happened to women throughout history. And so we are airing a month-long series in support of Women's History Month to share these stories, many of whom are largely unknown to history. Today, from producer Guy Rathbun and the series The Uppity Women in History, how Australia's wool industry got its start.
Welcome to the Fair Sex Calendar, where today in history, women make the news. This is in celebration of Women's History Month for the 31 days of March. True stories of women who chose to rock boats as well as cradles. Many are names you haven't heard of until author Vicki Leone brings their deeds to vivid life.
March 2nd, 1795. Today, an avid English innovator named Elizabeth Veal MacArthur breaks ground for her new home in Australia. Within 10 years, this self-educated go-getter turns her 200-acre spread into Australia's first wool export venture. Now, husband John sticks around for conjugal visits, but spends most of his time in England as the official spokesman for their wool business. Meanwhile, back at the ranch, Elizabeth runs a dairy while also raising hogs, sheep, and 7 human children. At age 49, this matriarch finally gets some applause of her own. The governor of Australia, no less, gives her an additional 600 acres in recognition of her work in agriculture. Today, her home is still known as Elizabeth Farm.
These and other true tales of outrageous women who refuse to button up or back down are drawn from the books by historical detective Vicki Leone. The newest of her 9 nonfiction titles on women's history is 4,000 Years of Uppity Women. Visit VickiLeone.com for more on her books, including ebook editions. Our theme music is by Café Musique, That Schoenberg Rag by Larry Unger.
Tomorrow in the series, an early American literary landmark from Sarah Kemple Knight. Up next, sunflower seeds.
Every March, the people in this town go out to the surrounding cattle acreages, and they cull the diamondback herds, and they gather up 1.5 tons of rattlesnake. And why they tell you this in weight, I don't know.
Join us next time for stories of rescue, widowhood, and rattlesnakes. That's the Moth Radio Hour from PRX.
Tonight at 8 Central, 7 Mountain, here on Prairie Public.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg, and in studio with me now is Chef Tim Rosendahl. We call him Chef Rosie. He joins us weekly to talk about food, and this week we are focusing in on sunflower seeds, part snack, part salad topping, part, I don't know, dessert enhancer.
Yeah, it has lots of different names for it, a lot of different uses. A sunflower seed is actually the fruit of a sunflower. Now, whether it's a seed or a nut or a fruit, that gets kind of complicated and it gets very botanical, but we'll just call them sunflower seeds for today in the culinary form.
Sure. And most of us, I think, are primarily familiar with it as a good snack at a baseball game, right?
Yes, it is the national seed of the National Baseball League and the National Softball League.
Okay.
So, you always see pitchers on the mound either with sunflower seeds in their mouth or chew.
Do we know how that got started?
No, and it is interesting, though, because, every time I go to a baseball game, whether it's even little kids, the different leagues, they're always chewing sunflower seeds. They're all over the field.
I'm not going to lie. I like sunflower seeds, but I can only eat them if they are already taken out of their shells. I lack that coordination to be able to break the shell and spit them out. So I end up kind of eating the shells if I try to do it raw, and it's not so pleasant.
When I buy just the seeds, I tend to eat way too many calorie counts of them because they're about 800 calories per cup of sunflower seed, and it's pretty easy to down a couple of cups.
Yeah.
Especially when you're on a long drive. It's really, they make the time go by very quickly.
But there's a lot of fat in things like peanuts and almonds and stuff, too. In terms of the good fat, bad fat, where do sunflower seeds rank?
Well, it's a polyunsaturated oil. Because they're very high in fat, they can go rancid very quickly. It's not an oil with a lot of flavor or especially good flavor. It has a rather low heat index, so it does burn very quickly.
You're not going to flash fry things
in sunflower
oil.
And some people use it in salad dressings because of the fact that it has very little flavor, like safflower oil. So when they don't want the oil as part of the flavor. Where when we use a good olive oil, we're looking for that flavor in the salad dressing.
Okay. Are there some things you can cook in it? Like would you want to saute in it with a low smoke point?
Well, when you're sauteing, you're cooking with high heat. So it's not an oil that I use, even though, 10% of the world's oil production is from sunflower seeds because of their high residual fat. And another interesting statistic is North Dakota is the number one state in the union for production of sunflower, followed by South Dakota, Minnesota, and then California. But we still don't produce anywhere near as a country as much sunflower oil or seeds as Russia. They produce more than double what we produce.
More than double?
Yes.
Okay.
Well, they're a little bigger country, too.
Well, how do you like to use sunflower seeds then?
Well, the common ways, of course, is snacking would be number one. They're great to use as croutons on salad. You see them on salad bars all the time because they hold their crunch. The mistake that a lot of salad bars make is they put the sunflower seeds in the same refrigerated case as the peaches and the oranges and the other salad condiments. So cold, they get mushy. I like to serve them warm. Mm-hmm. You know, I like them. And because of their high fat content, as I said earlier, they do become rancid quickly. So you have to be careful when you use them.
Are they the kind of thing you might want to toast a little first? Will that enhance the flavor at all?
Absolutely. Totally changes the flavor. You know, when you toast any nuts or grains or herbs or spices, you bring out the natural flavor. I think you more than double the taste anything you roast. I just finished roasting sunflower seeds, pumpkin seeds, pecans, pine nuts. Oh, I roasted them all because I love the flavor when they're toasted.
Any trick to that or just low heat over a pan on the stove?
Low and slow. Low and slow because if you're in a rush and you put the pan on high, once they're burnt, they're done. There's no good turning back the hands of time. And try to pick out the burnt ones. No, that doesn't work too well.
Would sunflower seeds themselves have a similarly short shelf life as if you are using a sunflower oil?
Well, the oil itself, you know, like most oils, you shouldn't store it in the sun. You shouldn't store it somewhere where there's a lot of heat, like above the oven or above the stove. People tend to put things because it's easy access when they're cooking. But you don't have to keep it in the refrigerator by any means. I'm not saying that. You're going to have 6 months of shelf life if you just keep it in the dark and keep it in a cool, dry place.
Okay. Does that apply to if you toast it too, or you want to toast it, use it, toast it, use it?
No. In fact, you know, I learned long ago from a great Mexican chef. He would, when all of his spices came in, he would take the full pound of basil or nutmeg or thyme and toast it and then put it all back in the can because you and maintain. Okay. And then use it for the next few months.
Okay.
Yeah. So the toasting, I just did 5 pounds of pine nuts, and they'll probably last for a week or two.
I know that almonds can be turned into almond flour, and we didn't settle our sunflower seeds, a seed or a nut, but can they be used sort of similar to like a nut in
They can be used. Flour has a lot of different uses. When we're talking about wheat flour, gluten flour, it's the gluten in flour that gives it strength and elasticity. Mm-hmm. And when you grind sunflower seeds, yes, you'll get flour, and yes, you can use it as a breading, and yes, you can use it as a thickening agent, but you're not going to be able to use it for the gluten, for the strength and elasticity that you have in bread. Can you replace some of the flour, like an all-purpose flour or bread flour with an almond, with a not an almond flour, a sunflower flour?
Sunflower flour. Sunflower flour.
Yeah, that's a tough one. Yes, you can. And that's what people do a lot of time. They want bread, but they also want to replace some of the gluten.
Okay.
And use a nut flour.
Okay. And good for breading then too? Like
yes. When you're doing what's called a Saint Germain breading, which is 3 steps of breading. It's flour, egg wash, breadcrumbs. The flour could easily be for that because then you're using the flour as glue. You're using it to stick the breading to get whether you're breading with Kellogg's cornflakes or bread or whatever you're breading.
Okay. So not so much gluten, but lots of glue.
Yeah.
Makes sense, right?
Yeah.
What's with all the flavors of sunflower seeds? There are just dozens. And I feel like when I was growing up, it was salted.
One.
Yeah. Right?
There was one flavor for the first many years of my life. And now, and it's not only are there hundreds of different flavors, but I've found it's interesting that they're partnering with big names in the food industry, such as Vlasic Dill Pickle and Stubbs Smoky Sweet Barbecue. And Hidden Valley Ranch and Old Bay Seasoning and Heinz Salt and Vinegar. So they're taking other big recognized names in the food industry and partnering with them so they get, of course, slotted in the grocery store, but also they want that recognized flavor that people know and love.
Do you see that a lot, that sort of hybrid or partnership? I can't think of anything else that seems like it's got that partnership.
There is lots of them. One I can tell you, for example, would be Tabasco. There used to be one Tabasco on the shelf, and now Tabasco is partnering. They make ribs. You know, they'll partner with a company who's making ribs, but there'll be Tabasco barbecue sauce. Tabasco is partnered with hundreds of companies, and so is Heinz, and so is other ketchup companies and other hot sauce companies. Okay. Like here, one I missed, it was Frank's Red Hot. You know, Frank's Red Hot became the chicken wing flavor profile that people loved, and now there's a Frank's Red Hot sunflower seed.
Hmm. That's an interesting trend in food production.
Well, you know, it is, and it's all about slottage. You know, there was a time when there was only Budweiser had one beer, Budweiser, and now they have hundreds, and some under different names, but there's light, and there's low-cal, and there's low-sodium, and there's gluten-free, and there's, you know, it's all about slottage in the grocery store. That's what they're looking for.
You mentioned that sunflower seeds have some sweet applications.
Just like you make peanut brittle or almond brittle, you could make sunflower brittle, and you could make it very easily. I mean, a real simple recipe would be take your favorite Minnesota maple syrup and pour it over sunflower seeds and bring it up to 235 degrees, hard crack, pour it out on a parchment paper or a greased cookie sheet, and make it sunflower brittle. Pretty darn good.
Well, like I need another excuse to go to the family farm for the syrup. All right.
Sprinkle that on top of ice cream. Yeah, sunflower has lots of sweet as well as savory applications.
All right. Thanks, Rosie. If you have a question for Chef Rosie, send it to mainstreet@prairiepublic.org, or you can find us on Facebook. We are Main Street at Prairie Public. Coming up next, Eric Dethridge joins me for What's Happening.
I'm Christopher Kimball from Milk Street Radio, and coming up on this week's show, I speak to Globetrotter Naomi Duguid. She's author of Taste of Persia and also Burma. Fuchsia Dunlop visits Milk Street and teaches me how to use a Chinese cleaver. Adam Gopnik opines on ethical eating, and Sarah Moulton helps me answer all of your cooking questions. Coming up this week on Milk Street Radio from PRX.
Sunday at 1 Central, noon Mountain, right here on Prairie Public.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
There it is. Such a great question. What is going on? It's Thursday. It's time for our What's Happening calendar of events. I'm Ashley Thornburg, and in studio with me today is Eric Dethridge. Eric, thanks so much for joining me today.
Oh, it is a pleasure, Ashley. Thanks for having me in.
We hear your voice so often during our great promo work, so we thought we'd have you in, talk about events.
Well, here we are, and we're going to kick it off with an event for folks over 50, and for those that are over 50 and love to write. Hey, you could take part in a creative nonfiction writing workshop hosted by award-winning authors Deborah Marcourt and Melanie Hoffert. The event, part of the North Dakota Seniors Speak Project, is happening on Saturday at the Prairie Village Museum in beautiful Rugby, North Dakota, from 9 a.m. until noon. Now, you can go online and submit your story to the North Dakota Seniors Speak blog. Then you can share it during an oral history collection, which happens the afternoon of the workshop. It's free. Seniors Speak Writing Workshop Saturday in Rugby.
And we have had both of those authors on Main Street, very talented women, so that would be a great opportunity to work on your writing skills. All right, the annual ArtLink Fiddle Festival this Saturday and Sunday, March 4th and 5th in Bismarck at the former Governor's Mansion State Historic Site in the North Dakota Heritage Center. This is area string students performing there, and they are going to be, well, performing all sorts of great string music, as you might expect, out of something called a fiddle festival in honor of the great ArtLink. This gets going at noon and again at 4 p.m. It is free Saturday and Sunday, March 4th and 5th in Bismarck at the Heritage Center. The ArtLink Fiddle Festival.
Well, from Jesse Jackson to Ted Cruz, people from all political persuasions can agree that Dr. Seuss kind of rules.
Yeah, he does. He's my favorite author, for sure.
Can't argue that. And in Minot on Saturday, you can celebrate the iconic children's author downtown at Main Street Books. A Seussical celebration features a downtown scavenger hunt. What's more fun than that? Story time, prizes and giveaways, plus yummy Seussical snacks. Green eggs and ham, anyone? Look at me, look at me, look at me now. It's fun to have fun, but you have to know how. A Seussical celebration, 12:30 p.m. Saturday at Main Street Books in Magic City.
Would you eat those snacks with a goat? Would you eat them on a boat? Would you eat them with a fox?
I would.
All right, the Kids Quest Happy Heads this Saturday the 4th in Fargo at the Plains Art Museum. Oh, this is about a poor slug, Peter. He was feeling down, but he set a goal and he did his very best to complete the Great Forest Race. And so this is just a great inspirational story for artists. And you can explore the museum and make animal hats and do all sorts of other creative illustrations with Peter the Slug and the Great Forest Race. 1 to 4 p.m. on Saturday the 4th at the Plains Art Museum, and it is free.
I feel like Peter the Slug sometimes.
Like
he thought he could, and he did. So that's a good message for artists, no doubt. Well, well on Sunday in Grand Forks at Red River Valley High School. The Greater Grand Forks Symphony Orchestra will present three of the greatest works by one of the greatest composers and arguably of all time. Talking about Ludwig van Beethoven, the Triumphal Beethoven Concert features a cycle of his most triumphal celebratory works, Egmont Overture, inspired by the struggles of the Dutch against Spain's oppression. Also the Fifth Symphony and Fifth Piano Concerto, The Emperor, subtitled for its magnificence and majesty. Dr. Nariaki Sugiura will be featured on the piano. Showtime is 2:30 p.m., and the cost is $25 for adults, $15 for members of the military, and for students.
The Insider Tour this Friday, so coming up tomorrow in Washburn at the Lewis and Clark Interpretive Center. If you ever have asked yourself, how does a museum make its artifacts last indefinitely? Because, first of all, that's the primary responsibility
yes,
there. They need to
curating.
Make sure those things are available for people to learn for generations to come. And also, a lot of those things can be very delicate, either to touch or to the elements. And so that actually does sound very fascinating. Learn how a museum makes its artifacts last with this behind-the-scenes tour. It takes about 90 minutes. It's from 7 to 8:30 on Friday the 3rd in Washburn at the Lewis and Clark Interpretive Center. The regular admission for this place is $7.50 for adults and $5 with a North Dakota State Parks annual pass.
Yeah, night at the museum. That sounds like a blast. Well, hey, kids, what's more fun than juggling balls, playing with marbles, yo-yos, and items that keep you moving? Well, I can't think of any, really. And in Minot, it's Science Sunday, Bodies in Motion at Nature's Nook on First Avenue Northwest. Join the Nature's Nook crew as they do assorted fun activities just moving their bodies around. Kids, you'll learn all about Bodies in Motion. The event is for children, 5 and up, but there are only 10 spots available for those wiggly bodies. It's Science Sunday, Bodies in Motion at Nature's Nook in Minot.
All right, I'm going to go for my event of the week, and that it is International Women's Day. Specifically, I'm going to pick an event on Wednesday the 8th in Fargo at the Revland Gallery, as you can join local nonprofit African Soul American Heart for an hors d'oeuvre celebration for International Women's Day. This organization raises money to build schools in South Sudan. International Women's Day celebrates the social, economic, and cultural political achievement of women around the globe. This gets going at 5:30 on the 8th at the Revland Gallery in Fargo. It is $75 per person. Remember, it is a fundraiser for building schools.
And Ashley, my event, well, we could all stand to learn a little bit more about a country that's in the news a lot right now, a very war-torn country. And, of course, there's lots of news about people fleeing it as well. We're talking about Syria. It's also a fascinating cradle of civilization. And on Sunday at the main library in Fargo at 2 p.m., you could take in a free presentation by Marianne Kadri called Colors and Culture of Syria. And you can learn about her family's history and her knowledge of Syrian culture. You'll see images of this diverse country and learn about Syria's festival, arts, languages, religions, and traditions.
That's what's happening. Dakota Datebook is next.
Mound Bayou, Mississippi was founded in 1887 with a vision to be an autonomous all-black community.
It's almost like it was an inverted, you know, or alternate universe where being black was a positive thing.
We'll take you there, plus the latest on Attorney General Jeff Sessions' meetings with the Russian ambassador on the next morning edition.
That's tomorrow morning right here on Prairie Public. This is Dakota Datebook for March 2nd. Leroy Milton Nays was born on this date in Fingal, North Dakota, in 1923. Leroy attended rural school and graduated from Fingal High in 1941. He started that fall at the Agricultural College in Fargo, but in December of 1942, he entered the Army Air Force and received his officer's commission as a second lieutenant in 1944. Shortly thereafter, he joined the 15th Air Force in Italy as a navigator bombardier on B-24 heavy bombers. On December 14th, while on a bombing mission to Linz, Austria,
Ney's plane was struck down by anti-aircraft fire, and two of the four engines were knocked out. The crew had to parachute over enemy territory in northern Yugoslavia, landing in the Sava River. Several of the crew drowned, but Ney's and three others were picked up by Yugoslavian civilians on a raft and stayed with them for 6 days. They were able to contact the anti-German partisan forces led by Joseph Broz Tito and evaded the Germans for the next month. On Christmas morning, Leroy awoke to what he thought was gunfire and thought they were being attacked by German forces. Unknown to Ney's, the Yugoslavs celebrated Christmas with fireworks, much like we do on the 4th of July. Ney's and the rest of his crew, protected by the partisans, finally made their way to an emergency airstrip in late January of 1945. They were flown back to Italy on a C-47, where Leroy spent time recuperating in a hospital. Ney's made it back to his base and flew 12 more missions before the war in Europe ended. The last several missions, they did not carry bombs, but dropped food and supplies into prisoner-of-war camps. Ney's was discharged from the Air Force in December of 1945. He returned to North Dakota, went back to school in Fargo, and graduated with a Bachelor of Science degree in agriculture. He married, started a family, and farmed near McCluskey until 1944, when the family returned to a farm near Fingal. In 1956, Leroy was recruited to work for the Farmers Home Administration of the USDA, which began a 27-year career administering loans to farmers in North Dakota. He was the head of the Farm Loan Division for 10 years until he retired in 1983. Leroy Ney's passed away on March 23, 2014. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Scott Nelson. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from the North Dakota Humanities Council.
Maybe humans are what happens when high intelligence evolves in an animal that also has hands, and dolphins are what happens when more extravagant intelligence evolves in an animal without hands.
Close encounters of the earthly kind.
That was un-f***ing believable. Oh, that was so cool.
That's on the next Radio Lab.
Saturday at noon, 11 Mountain, right here on Prairie Public.
That's it for this Thursday edition of Main Street. Coming up tomorrow on the program, Scott Pruitt's confirmation as the head of the Environmental Protection Agency has alarmed the National Wildlife Federation. Here to explain is the Federation's president and CEO, Colin O'Mara. We're also going to continue our series, Journeys Through Justice, from producer Meg Luther Lindholm as she visits with legislators about drug addiction and incarceration rates. It's Friday. We'll hear from News Director Dave Thompson to talk about the week's headlines, and Matt O'Lean reviews 20th Century Women. That's all coming up tomorrow on Main Street. Until then, enjoy the rest of your evening.